We will begin this morning with introductions from the court. My name is Mike Havigan and I am the Chief Justice and now by order of seniority as to service on the court, the other members of the court will introduce themselves.
Good morning. This is Justice Lindsay Miller Lerman appearing by WebEx.
William Castle, good morning.
Good morning, Stephanie Stacy.
Good morning, Jeff Funk.
Jonathan Pappick.
And John Frydenberg.
Thank you, members of the court. Folks who are here in the courtroom, we appreciate it if you keep your masks on when you are not presenting. And when you are presenting, please take your mask off so that we can hear and understand what you have to say. Likewise, the court, we will not have our masks on so that you can hear and understand us. Counsel, Mr. Spray, you're here this morning. Good morning to you. And Ms. Walton, you are on WebEx, is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Good morning to you. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin? Very good. This is the case of In Re Estate of Beltran. And Mr. Spray, you may approach and you may proceed.
I've reserved 3.5 minutes for rebuttal.
You may.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is J.L. Spray. I'm appearing today on behalf of the appellate, Mario Beltran, who is an heir at law and an interested person by definition in the estate of his father, late father Armengol Beltran. Mario filed a verified petition with the probate court, asking the court to invoke the authority under 30-402 of the Nebraska Probate Code. I'll just stop for a minute and make a distinction. The Nebraska Probate Code includes this section of the Chapter 30 that is not in the Uniform Probate Code. It's unique to Nebraska. He asked the court to cite another heir for taking money and assets from the estate before and after the decedent died, and particularly while he was subject to a guardianship conservatorship.
Counsel, did a substantially identical statute exist, identical to 30-402, exist before the Uniform Probate Code was adopted? And if so, have we interpreted it and what did we say about it?
Well, the last interpretation that I saw relative to that without drilling down on it was a comment by Justice Girard, which I think was dicta in the, I'm not gonna pronounce it right, the McCurrell case we cited extensively in our brief. I thought took it as a common law right to bring a action in district court by a personal representative or an heir at law to basically litigate issues related to the estate. I think the law is clear today that only the personal representative has standing to bring an action against an heir or a third party to collect assets for the estate.
Do you view 30-402 as a statute that is contemplating that being the vehicle for bringing an action to adjudicate, or is it something different?
Well, let's start with the judge's order in this case. The judge's order in a case that the alternative would be to remove the PR and start over. I'm personally relatively convinced that this statute was passed as a gap filler relative to the Uniform Probate Code that doesn't really give an heir a vehicle to address this issue with the court. And it, the liberality of 402 is such, in my opinion, that you can use it for all kinds of things to get in front of the court and get the court and the person represented to act. Judge Parsley took a much more narrow view of it.
Is it frequently used in Nebraska?
Not to my knowledge. I believe this is a case of first impression for the court.
Is it, could it be characterized as a discovery statute?
Maybe in part. I know issues like that were brought up here have been brought on original actions in mandamus before this court. And I certainly thought about that. My client thought about that at the time. But this seemed like a necessary step once we'd gotten there in order to make a complete record and be sure that we were heard on this issue on appeal, rather than lose our appeal rights because of a final order subsequent that would bind us to that. And so that's why we filed the appeal.
Was discovery tried before this motion was filed?
Yes. I brought not paper discovery, but a deposition, Dukas Tecum. The witness appeared in the record, I think it's Exhibit 18. It's a transcript of the portion of the exhibit where the witness refused, absolutely refused to even look for the documents requested to the subpoena, Dukas Tecum. The subpoena was never objected to. So I brought a motion to compel when they refused. And the trial judge refused to enforce the subpoena. And subsequently, we had no opportunity to conduct discovery. And this was sort of a last recourse, short of a mandamus action.
Did the trial judge say why they refused to enforce the subpoena?
There is an order. It's 2 pages. And I think her conclusion was that it wasn't relevant. And there was no objection to relevance presented either at the hearing or on the record, and certainly no written motion to quash or anything. So it was, I gather, sui sponte on the judge's part that the determination that it wasn't relevant. But of course, bank records are the penultimate point of discovery on financial transactions. I don't think there's any more.
Did you ask for bank records or tax records?
Both, Your Honor. And in particular, tax records, because my client thought that the tax records would reflect an honest reflection of what was taken vis-a-vis reporting on the income.
I beg your pardon. This is Justice Miller-Lerman. Does it matter if there exist other vehicles, other statutory methods to obtain the information your client seeks?
I don't think so, because this particular vehicle is available. I don't know where your camera is, but this particular vehicle is available to us, and we're asking the court to give us guidance on whether this is available or not. And that's frankly the point of the appeal, is the substantive issue. So,
well, one of the issues is this a final appeal order? Can you address that?
I sure can, Your Honor, and I think there are several reasons why. First, of course, is the right to conduct discovery as to assets of the estate, and bad acts perpetrated on the decedent are substantial, and they're essential to the core purpose of a probate proceeding. I mean, the core purpose of a probate proceeding is to gather together the assets of the estate, to have an order from the court to determine who's entitled to them, and to make it a distribution of them. Proceedings under the Nebraska Probate Code have been, prior to today, determined to be special proceedings, both generally and specifically with regard to a special administrator. And we didn't get this in the brief. I apologize for that. But if you look at 30-401, it defines personal representative and special administrator as being one and the same per section 400-401 at seek of chapter 30. I'm out of time now. I'd like to reserve for my rebuttal unless there are some immediate questions.
Well, I do have an immediate question. 30-402, I think, is phrased in terms of the judge may do this and the judge may do that, and there's no shell in that statute at all. How does that affect your ultimate argument that this is a substantial right?
I agree with your point about the word may. I agree that that's the sole. It's a discretionary thing. We're asking that the court find there was abuse of discretion and reverse of direction. But the statute goes to what is an essential right, which is the right to have the estate. The court is the gatekeeper of an estate. The personal representative is their actor, owes a duty to the court. But the essential right is to have the estate done correctly. And that is an essential right. That's the only right of probate proceeding, is to get the estate together and distribute it properly. Thank you.
Ms. Walton, good morning to you again.
Good morning.
And you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the court, my name is Karen Walton. I represent Marina Beltran Barrett, who is the appellee in this case. We are in agreement with the county court's opinion that the request in the verified motion neither conforms to the type of request that can be granted nor the procedure set forth pursuant to Nebraska Revised Stats 30-402 or Nebraska Revised Statute Section 3024-65. We also believe that it's not a final order. It did not deprive the appellant of any substantial right. It was a discovery request and by the appellant to examine Ms.
Is discovery a substantial right? And if it's not allowed at this point in the proceedings, is it foreclosed later?
I don't believe it's foreclosed, Your Honor. I believe it's discovery is generally looked at as not a substantial right. The appellant had the right to examine my client in the courtroom on March 18th of 2020. He chose not to. He chose to examine the personal representative. My client was there ready to testify. She was there with her documents. And he also continued the deposition of my client. He had a deposition of her husband, and the court found that tax returns back to the time that the person was 16 were not relevant to the proceedings. And it just wasn't relevant. The court found it wasn't relevant to have Mr. Bruce Barrett be deposed and bring those tax returns and his bank accounts. I mean, it was just a voluminous request, Your Honor.
Is that why the judge rejected it? Because it was a voluminous request?
Well, she rejected it because she didn't feel it was relevant to the proceedings because he wasn't an heir. He was a third party. And she found that the appellant did not provide reasonable relevance for requesting the private records of Mr. Barrett. And it was not relevant to the probate of the estate.
So if the procedure wasn't followed properly here, what is your position on the proper order of operations in something filed under this statute?
Well, the appellant could have cross-examined my client or had examined her at that time of the hearing to show if there was any kinds of he wants to twist the facts and say that there was fraud, there was concealment, there was all of these things that my client did not perpetrate. We believe he could have examined her at that hearing, and that would have been his recourse. But he continues to want to twist the facts and not see what the see that my client had a trusting relationship with her parents. Whereas the appellant, he had was estranged from his father for many years. He finally got back into a relationship with his father, within a year before his father died. He is the only one that was trying to convert funds by filing a temporary conservatorship. And when he knew full well, and he testified
you've answered my question on procedure. Thank you.
We also believe that the appellant's brief and his statements have been prejudicial to my client. She did not attempt to convert any funds. She was a joint owner with her dad on the accounts. They had been that way for many years. And they clearly knew, and they testified that she was the person that paid his bills. He trusted to pay his bills.
What do you understand as the reason why the county court denied the petition that was filed under 30-402?
I believe that she didn't feel like it was the proper method to bring a verified petition before the court. And it was actually It was not the right procedure, and I think that's the reason that she denied it. She didn't rule on the merits.
In what way was it not the right procedure?
30-402 goes to the it goes to the personal representative, heir, devisee, creditor, or any other person interested in the estate. Upon application, under oath, given information that a person may have concealed that, embezzled, carried away, or disposed of any money. Such person may have his or her possession of knowledge of deeds. That the appellant did not have any knowledge, I mean, did not have any substantial evidence that my client had done this.
Is that why the county court denied the petition, or did the county court deny the petition because there wasn't language saying that the appellant wanted to examine your client under oath?
Procedural. I believe that the judge, she didn't rule on the merits. We didn't really have a hearing on the merits of the petition. Because he didn't examine my client who was there, and I believe that she ruled on it because it was procedurally wrong.
I beg your pardon. Do you think that what the trial court was doing was in effect interpreting the statute, giving us the trial court's view of how it works?
I believe so. Your Honors, I also believe that she overruled the motion for Bruce Barrett to cite Bruce Barrett to provide his private his personal documents. That was an order that was because it wasn't relevant to the proceedings.
I'm sorry, Ms. Walton. Can you go back to Justice Miller-Lerman's question about whether or not the trial court judge was interpreting the statute 30-402. I didn't hear your answer.
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I indicated, yes, I believe she was interpreting the statute.
Thank you. And what do you think that interpretation was?
It was not the type of request that could be granted by section 3402. And
counsel, what is your client's view of how 30-402 should operate? What does it do, and how does someone use it?
I believe that the appellant was asking that the personal representative could have brought it. The personal representative, I mean, he was asking the personal representative to a question for the personal representative. The personal representative said he didn't feel that it was so far, the loans and the loans that the appellant was talking about, he didn't feel that that was something that was maybe judicially or judicious in this case. He felt that there wasn't that many assets that he could continue to investigate every question that the appellant had. And I believe that the judge felt that the personal representative was the one to request this. And the personal representative,
402, limit itself to actions by the personal representative?
That's a good question.
Doesn't it use a term like party of interest? Doesn't it use a pretty broad term?
It does. But it also, it gives the personal representative the right to do that if somebody questions that, or questions that there is concealment or fraud or other actions that are in 30-402.
So do you think that the county court judge was saying, try this other method first? Have the have the excuse me, the personal representative do this before we have you, the current petitioner, do any further discovery using 402. Is that what the county judge was trying to say?
Not sure, Your Honor. I just think that the judge, I'm not really sure.
Thank you. And thank you. I think your time is up.
It is. That's what it is.
Very good.
Thank you,
Your Honor. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. 2 minutes, 7 seconds.
2 minutes and 7 seconds, Mr. Spray.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. What the trial court was doing is pretty clear in the order. The request neither conforms to the type of request that can be granted pursuant to 3402, nor the procedure set forth in it. So we didn't get to what she describes as step two, which is the court citing the person to come to court to be under oath to address the issues raised in the, and again, I styled it as a petition because that's how we do things normally in probate court that are going to be contested. It could have been a complaint. That's a word used in the statute. It could have been an application, but
doesn't 30-402 require an application?
Right, and we filed that, Your Honor.
And doesn't that somehow distinguish it from the petition route that's ordinarily used in other types of proceedings under the Uniform Probate Code?
For instance, an application for informal probate that doesn't have a hearing and isn't contested is done on an application. But a contested matter where you're asking for a hearing or, but again, it's not clear. You know, I don't think Thomas Jefferson wrote this statute.
Suppose that one might posit as the interpretation of that section that anyone who's interested in the estate, whether it's the PR, heir, devisee, whoever, and believes that there's some skullduggery that's gone on, has a certain scope of that skullduggery may be pursued to find out what's out there by filing the application that's verified and sets forth all the facts that the applicant has. And the county court either says, yes, we're going to order so-and-so to appear and testify, or they say, no, you haven't set forth enough. Isn't that a sensible interpretation of the procedure?
Yes, Your Honor, but it's so broad and it talks about complaining. And what we were doing in court, just to be clear that day, we were trying to prove up enough evidence under oath to get a citation from the judge. We were not there under a citation that had already been issued.
Do you think you have to prove up something? Don't you think the application stands on its own merits?
It very well may, Your Honor. And maybe I was belts and suspenders on this, but okay. I had evidence I wanted to put on beyond the application.
Chief, a question about it,
sir.
Counsel, is there anything about Judge Parsons' order on your application or petition that prevents you from going back and filing another under the same statute, more directly asking for the citation to issue, setting out the facts on which you base that request, and going forward with discovery that way? Are you prevented somehow from doing that by her order?
I don't think so, but I'm afraid without making this appeal, I could be foreclosed somehow from not following up on it, is why we're here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chief.
Thank you very much. That concludes arguments on In Re Estate of Beltran. Counsel, Ms. Walton, thank you for appearing by WebEx, and Mr. Spray, thank you for being here personally today. You were both excused, and the court will go on to the next case of the day, which is Heist versus Department of Correctional Services.